the free community kitchen at a Sikh temple in Olathe, Ramveer Singh stands shoeless on slabs of cardboard. He keeps a long beard and uncut hair tucked away under a black turban. It's Sunday morning, and he's preparing Kara Prasad, a traditional dish for worship. This dish, kind of like bread, is lovingly prepared in Sikh temples all over the world. The making of Kara Prasad in India kicks off the bread chapter of Simran Sethi's new book, Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and author Simran Sethi joins us now from the studios of KPR in Lawrence. Hi, Simran.
Good morning, Gina.
We're going to get back to that temple in Olathe shortly, but first, tell me what inspired you to write this book.
I was in Italy doing research for another project, looking at genetically modified organisms, and every scientist I spoke with said, yeah, that's an issue in your country, but what we're worried about is the loss of agricultural biodiversity. And Gina, this kind of knocked me out because I, you know, was someone who taught all my classes at KU through the lens of food. I've been working on environmental issues for over a decade, and I just didn't know what he was talking about. You know, as someone who I thought I knew good food and loved food and farming so much, I found myself absolutely confused that I knew nothing of this issue. And essentially what the loss of agricultural biodiversity is a loss in the diversity in every single element that makes food food. So the loss of diversity in the soil, the loss of diversity in seeds, the loss of diversity in pollinators, in plants, in animals, in aquatic life. It moves all the way up the food chain, and it really compromises what we're able to eat today and what we'll be able to eat in the future. And as soon as I learned of this, I redirected my research. I changed my concept for my book, and I ended up, you know, leaving my position at KU, selling my house, giving away my car, and embarking on a five-year journey across six continents to understand this story and tell the stories of the deep kind of origins of food and the changes in our food system through bread, wine, coffee, chocolate, and beer.
So you, I mean, what happened to you in Italy must have been incredibly profound. And in fact, you write about it in the book, but to inspire you to the point of, yeah, uprooting your whole life, selling your house, leaving a position at a university. Can you tell me more about the passion that was triggered there?
Absolutely. I mean, truly the passion comes from the statistics from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, which has shown that 3/4 of our food comes from 12 plants and 5 animals. And now 95% of the calories that we consume come from 30 species. If you think about it this way, Gina, when you go to a grocery store, it looks like you have tons of choice. You know, I mean, when I first started telling people what I was writing about, they all looked at me like I had two heads, you know, like, lack of diversity? What do you mean? But behind every one of those foods is actually a rapidly shrinking diversity in what we grow and in what we eat. So, for example, if you think about ice cream, butter, milk, sour cream, yogurt, 90% of all of those dairy products comes from exactly one cow. And for me, realizing
this, one type
of cow. One type of cow. Exactly. What did I say?
One cow.
One cow. One type. Exactly. Definitely not one. That would be a very tired cow. Yeah. One type of cow. It's the Holstein Frisian. And this is, you know, I mean, this is a treacherous way to build a food system. You would never put 90% of your savings into one stock, for example, and think like, oh, okay, everything's going to be okay. You know, but that's exactly what we're doing with food. The global trend now, there are researchers who analyzed 50 years of data on what 98% of the world eats. And they found on a local level, we do see like more diversity, right? So I'm sitting in Lawrence, Kansas right now. You'll see mangoes maybe in December. Obviously, they don't grow here, but that's the result of globalization. But the global trend is down to five foods: wheat, rice, corn, soybeans, and palm oil. And again, that's a treacherous way to build a food system. And we have have examples of this in the past, the Irish potato famine, you know, where 1/8 of the population died, about 1 million people, when the potatoes succumbed to a single disease. And now the way we grow food, largely in monocultures and with very few varieties, we're setting ourselves up for some more of these problems.
You know, you've gotten a lot of praise for writing essentially a treatise on food sustainability, a very, you know, stark kind of topic, but without being dreary about it, you aren't suggesting that people put a low priority on thinking about food the way they already do, through enjoyment. You actually kind of make the opposite argument, that loving foods is how we preserve them. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. So here I've kind of laid out the problem, right? We're in this really treacherous state. I describe in the book that, like, as far as a food pyramid goes, the point is now as fine as Seattle's Space Needle. And it's not the right way to grow food. You know, it's not the right way to secure food for the future. Conservationists have laid out three ways to save food, and that is ex situ conservation, which, if you think of a seed bank or something like that, there's the global seed bank in Svalbard, you know, between the Arctic Circle and Norway, that people have heard a lot about. But we have seed banks all over the country, and we also save other kinds of things. We save cow embryos. We save honeybee sperm. This is all in an attempt to ensure that we'll have that diversity we might need later. So if a potato or a banana succumbs to a disease, or, you know, the variability and the serendipity of climate change, we don't know exactly what will happen, we'll be able to go back, look at what we have, the diverse varieties we have, and then breed some of those traits into existing foods, right? So disease resistance or drought tolerance, that backup system is critical. But, you know, a seed bank or any kind of repository can only hold so much. So what we also need is in situ conservation in the wild. And what that means is saving wild places, saving forests, saving the places where these plants and animals thrive. And not only those specific plants and animals, but all of their wild relatives. Sometimes we need to reach further out into the family tree and grab what we call a crop wild relative. So, you know, like the crazy cousin on the side. And again, look and see what traits they have. The third way is in situ conservation on farms. So anyone who's been to a farmer's market and seen these really gorgeous varieties of heirloom tomatoes, for example, that's in situ conservation of diversity right there. But what conservationists haven't done is included us as part of the equation or the solution. So I believe we, the eaters, have this extraordinary opportunity to transform our food system. Farmers can't grow what we won't eat. And with just a slight pivot, we can start to reshape things. Colin Corey, who's the researcher that I talked to about what's known now as this global standard diet of, you know, wheat, rice, corn, palm oil, and soybeans, said to me that anything outside of these five foods is a revolutionary act. And his exact quote was, eating olive oil is now a revolutionary act. So the minute we start to pivot in the grocery store, the minute we start to turn a label and look and see what's there, the minute we choose a vegetable we've never tried before, we're already making a difference in helping to sustain biodiversity.
You have picked foods other than bread that are not the ones we think of as, like, crucial for survival. They are, you know, coffee, wine, beer, chocolate. These are, in our diets anyway, much more about indulgence than sustenance. That's not the case for the people producing those foods. But the bread chapter is different in that sense. It is about sustenance. Why do you think it was important to include bread?
So I'll back up a second and kind of tell you a little bit about my journey. I was going to write a book about, you know, corn and potatoes and rice. And I was sitting in my little apartment in Italy, desperately trying to write the corn chapter. And I thought, you know, Michael Pollan kind of already wrote this chapter, the best corn chapter ever in The Omnivore's Dilemma. Like, I can't do this. And honestly, I don't think I'd miss potatoes that much. And I went back to the United States shortly thereafter. I was on a cleanse, trying to cleanse out all the wine and delicious food I'd been, you know, consuming in Italy. And I end up meeting a botanist who had become a chocolate maker. I visited the chocolate factory, and, you know, I had thought in my head, okay, I'm going to write a book about these nutritional staples, you know, and then I'll sprinkle a little wine on top for color and throw in a little chocolate. But what I realized when I was visiting the Cho Chocolate Factory, which was then in San Francisco, was how much I loved these foods. You know, I mean, I ended up touching the machine that melts down the chocolate, like, you know, like it was like a lover. You know, I mean, I just was so overcome with joy for this substance. And I realized chocolate has been my every birthday cake. Chocolate was my wedding cake. Chocolate got me through my divorce. Coffee sets the tone of every single day of my adult life. And these are the things that I don't want to have disappear. And I didn't want to have this conversation with people who were already food obsessed, you know, in the kind of foodie sort of way. I wanted to reach out and talk to people who weren't already involved, but who also cherished their foods, who also woke up to Folgers in their cup, who also loved, you know, winding down their day with a beer from Boulevard. You know, that this belongs to all of us, and the solutions do too. So the food choices I made were very deliberate and went through many permutations, but they really ended up being the ones that I loved or the ones that I thought people universally loved. And what was interesting is they're also the ones that a lot of people tell us that we shouldn't eat. But I believe we should eat really good varieties of them and be very grateful for it. So to get back to your point of wheat is a nutritional staple, but for so many faiths, it's also a spiritual staple. So I went back to my home country of India and went to the largest Sikh temple in the world. It's in Amritsar, India, which is in the state of Punjab, where my family, my people are from, which is the wheat state of India. And it's lovely that I spent so much time in the wheat state of the United States, Kansas. And I traced that wheat from the holy site where the Kara Prasad is made. It's the blessing that's given to every person who visits the Golden Temple, and of any faith, everyone is welcome, all the way back to the fields and the farmers of Punjab. And then I took that same story and went back to where I grew up in North Carolina and started to talk about wheat there and how it has transformed that local economy.
Well,
in Asheville, North Carolina.
Let's stick with the Kara Prasad tell me about your memories of that. First of all, what is the significance of this substance, and can you describe it for us?
Sure. So it's kind of like a creamy, buttery cream of wheat, really. It's wheat pudding, and it's something I've known my whole life. I grew up in the United States, but I would visit India on a regular basis and go with my grandmother, who would do what I describe in the book as the prayer circuit, right? We're Hindu and Sikh in my family, Sikh, as many people pronounce it. So we would go to all of these temples, and, you know, every time we went, I was ready for my, you know, Kara Prasad, right? But I thought of it more as a blessed dessert. You know, I just kind of was waiting for the sweet part at the end after the priest greeted us and what have you. And I never considered that as an embodiment of something sacred, you know, and I never considered how so many faiths use that same symbol of wheat as a symbol of transformation. And what happened when I was at the Golden Temple was I learned after many days there, people don't have access to the area where the Kara Prasad is made.
Well,
but
yeah,
let's
get to that in just a second. I want to take us to the actual making of this, maybe something similar to bread, this wheat substance. Yesterday morning, KCUR's Andrea Tedhope visited a temple in Olathe and sat in on the making of Kara Prasad. Let's listen in on her visit.
Every Sunday morning at the Sikh temple in Olathe, Kansas, hundreds of people gather to kneel and worship before a priest reciting the day's hymns from the Holy Scripture.
Sometimes commonly also referred to as a temple, but the official word is the Gurdwara.
Amar Singh is a volunteer for this Gurdwara, where he spends as much time as he can planning events, cleaning and maintaining the temple, and practicing Sikhism, an Indian religion that dates back to the late 1400s, when the first guru began teaching.
Any Gurdwara is just not only a place of worship, it's also a place of shelter. So if anybody need a place to stay overnight, they can get a place to stay. If they need food to eat, they can well get food to eat. It's equal, it's free, it's available anytime to anybody who need.
The basement of the building houses the Langar Hall, where priests, devotees, and visitors gather to eat and drink.
Basically, we all sit down, eat the same food. Nobody gets less or more gets discriminated in any other ways. The reason we sit down on the floor, meaning that we can be as close to the earth or the ground as possible so that our egoism goes away.
Next to the hall is the constantly active kitchen, where leaders of the faith cook snacks, meals, and the Kara Prasad. This is the dish served at Sikh ceremonies in the presence of the Holy Scripture, the Guru Granth Sahib, and prayer. It's a bread of sorts. The ingredients are simple. Equal parts ghee, or clarified butter, whole wheat flour, and sugar. Kara Prasad is a central part of the Sikh practice, and it is prepared by the priests who live and work in the Gurdwara.
My name is Ranveer Singh. I am priest here in temple.
Ranveer mainly speaks Punjabi. He takes us through the process of preparing, cooking, and blessing the bread, explaining each step in his language. He scoops out about a cup of ghee into the pan to melt. Next, he pours in a cup of whole wheat flour and explains that he will stir until it turns brown. He prepares a pitcher of hot water and pours in about a cup of sugar and stirs it until it dissolves. When he turns back to the pan, he continues stirring the flour and ghee. Ranveer was stirring in silence until...
He was reciting hymns without speaking out, so I just asked him to be audible.
And the process came to light. Amar explained to me later that it is during the cooking that the kara becomes kara prasad, or in other words, that the bread becomes holy bread.
When you are singing all the hymns or the prayers, as you are making it, that makes it prasad. Prasad can be of anything. But in Gurdwaras, usually it's the kara that is served as a prasad.
Back in the kitchen, the mixture hisses as Ranveer pours the sugar water, the final ingredient, into the pan and continues to stir. He points to the butter that has begun to pool on top of the kara prasad. It is ready. He transfers the bread into a clean bowl, which he then covers with foil and carries on his head upstairs to the holy shrine. In the main room of worship, another priest recites hymns into a microphone from the slightly elevated shrine as Amar and I kneel onto the carpeted floor. We cup our hands as Ranveer provides each of us with an equal-sized pinch of the kara prasad, which is served at room temperature. It's spongy, kind of like a bready pudding, and the taste is simple, buttery and subtly sweet. And he says, taste does matter.
It does. I mean, you don't want to have a salt in there, obviously. But that's not the significance of it. Significance is you're sharing something that's a common without prejudice to anybody. And when you get prasad, essentially your presence has been recorded. You has been acknowledged. You're not leaving the Gurdwara without getting anything to take with you.
And on that note, at the end of the visit...
And one final thing. Can I offer you the breakfast that was being cooked?
Sure. That was KCUR's Andrea Tudhope off to try the kara prasad. Simran, did that take you back to what you witnessed at the Golden Temple in India?
It did, but if you can imagine making that same kara, which becomes kara prasad, through the prayers for 100,000 visitors a day. So my experience was sort of being in the kitchen of giants, you know?
Yeah.
Everything was supersized and really big, and there were multiple people. I mean, that mixture becomes thicker, like if you thickening oatmeal as it cooks or cream of wheat as it cooks, so it gets very hard to stir. And it's an incredible experience. And I would say, you know, what I learned as I was there was I kept trying to find out what is this moment when it becomes holy, because they are chanting the prayers, and they're, you know, we are on the holiest site for Sikhs in the world. And Sikh comes from the word Sikhna, to learn. And our final incarnation of the teacher, of the guru, is the holy book, right? So these people are surrounding the kara and waiting. And what I learned was that the moment that it actually becomes holy is the moment that it is shared. It is sliced in half with a ceremonial sword. And when it is given to the other person, so when it is shared between two, is when it becomes considered sanctified. And for me, that was an incredibly beautiful, moving moment to understand that what we do through our faith and how we care for each other is how food becomes sanctified and holy and good.
You know, so then by contrast, the wheat they use to make kara prasad at the Golden Temple, it turns out to have a sort of ominous significance in the storyline that you weave. What did you find out about the wheat used for this holy food?
Well, as with most of the world, you know, the wheat is grown now in monoculture. And this is the result of the Green Revolution, which had its starts in really trying to feed hungry people throughout the world. But it brought about a set of protocols, a set of agricultural protocols that were really about using irrigation in areas. So using, you know, amounts of water in areas that were traditionally rain fed and starting to put inputs in all of these crops. So herbicides and pesticides that were not formally used, and in growing things in monoculture and fertilizing the soil. So what's happened over time is the very country that was hungry is now still hungry, but has grown copious amounts of wheat, and in the process has lost a lot of the traditional ways of growing wheat and a lot of the diversity. And what we're facing now in Punjab, the water table has dropped, the soil is polluted with an incredible amount of inputs, cancer rates have gone up, and we're seeing that, you know, we're facing in Punjab, the wheat state of India, a modern day Dust Bowl. So this notion of growing everything in a cookie cutter way is not the best way to grow food for the world. And the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has confirmed this. Agroecology, where we grow foods in polycultures, where we work to nourish the soil, where we grow diverse varieties and use diverse seeds, is the way that we can feed people today and into the future.
In your attempt to figure out how the wheat came to be, I mean, as the people in the temple were calling it poison, you end up in a really heated conversation with a young Punjabi guy in the wheat industry. Can you tell us about that conversation?
I wouldn't call it heated. I would call it impassioned. So the word that we use in Punjabi for these inputs, right, the general word is the vai. The vai means medicine. But when it was translated, I understand Punjabi, so I know they're using the term Dvai, but they're calling it poison. The inputs that they're putting on these crops, including wheat, are inputs that they know are unhealthy, but they feel locked into an agricultural system where they no longer have any choice. So I turned to two of the farmers who looked a lot like my uncles, and I said, "You're growing this for me. I am a Punjabi girl. Like, you're poisoning me." And I started to cry. So I want to make clear, it wasn't heated. It was emotional. And it was heartbreaking for me because in their home gardens, they were growing for themselves diverse crops that were devoid of a lot of these inputs. You know, but for commercial means, in order to feed themselves and pay themselves, they were having to succumb to the system that they knew wasn't healthy. And they felt like they had no choice. And the farmer said to me, "Becoming a slave takes time. And getting free takes time."
And he asks you a question. He asks you whether you work in an office. What's the meaning of that question? Because it seems like you have also a transformation in your understanding when he asks you that.
Absolutely. So the son of this farmer said to me, "Madam, do you work in an office?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, sometimes." And he said, "I would like to too." And I realized, again, I was humbled. There were moments on this journey where I was so humbled. When I realized if we demand organic coffee, for example, those farmers in Guatemala and Honduras who are now declaring states of emergency because a disease is wiping out their coffee crops, if they can't use some chemical inputs, those coffee plants are gone. This was another one of those moments when I realized, oh my gosh, he wants a different kind of life because farming is so difficult. But the challenge is, the truth is, he probably will end up in an office. He probably will be one of those guys you hear on the end of the phone calling, you know, in a call center somewhere in India, because agriculture as we know it in India is disappearing. And so these are the tensions, Gina, that we have to grapple with now. Any absolutist position in any direction is not going to help us solve these problems. And I learned that here in Kansas when my neighbors were farmers, and I finally understood what it meant to really have to face these struggles and to be able to respect, you know, the various methods that people use to allow food to grow and their lives to flourish.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear some about more of the indulgent foods that environmental journalist Simran Sethi enjoyed for research purposes, of course, and we'll bring a local chocolatier in on the discussion. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with environmental journalist Simran Sethi about her new book, Chocolate Bread Wine, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. She'll be giving a talk at KU tomorrow evening with a reception that includes some of the foods from the book. You can get details about that at thecommons.ku.edu. Hi again, Simran.
Hi, Gina.
You write about growing up with parents from India in the American South and how that shaped your relationship with food. When you think of comfort food, what springs to mind?
Collards, barbecue, and that would be Southern barbecue, not Kansas City, okay, and grits, along with rajma, which is Indian kidney beans, and bhartha, which is a roasted eggplant dish that we make. So these things all live on my tongue and all live in my heart and are the comfort foods that I go to.
You make the argument that if your mom hadn't preserved a connection to Indian cuisine in your household, that you wouldn't care about those foods and you wouldn't notice if they disappeared. And I'm curious about that as an argument about how we go about preserving diversity in food. I mean, can liking a food play a significant role in preventing it from disappearing?
I believe so. I wrote this whole book through the lens of flavor. Talking to, addressing how we experience the taste of something. Everything from the weight of the bowl to the contents in the bowl to the people that we're eating with, the lighting, the music, every one of our senses factors into our experience of food. And it is a constantly evolving construct. So for me, what I realized was that once we started to understand how we could savor these foods, we really had an opportunity to take a closer look and save them. And when I say that, there is a cultural erosion that accompanies this loss of agricultural biodiversity, what scientists call a genetic erosion. And that is traditional farming methods, traditional cooking methods. How do we even know how to grow or cook these things anymore? I remember I used to belong to a community-supported agriculture. I had a membership in New York City, and I would get these vegetables, and I didn't even know what some of them were, you know, much less how to prepare them. That's what we can bring back. This has all happened. I'm 45 years old. This is all changed. So much of this change, I should say, not all of it, has happened in our lifetimes, in my lifetime, in the last 50 years. So we have a real opportunity here to change things around and turn it back. And we all have a memory of something that isn't around anymore. You know, a peach that was particularly sweet in the summer, or something our grandmother used to make and that we can't find anymore, or something a small store used to stock that doesn't exist anymore. Those memories mean something. They're part of who we are, and they're part of who we will be. I believe this is a very strong part of our legacy, and I think the opportunities that we have to save foods by savoring them is unprecedented and great.
You express a problem with the idea that certain people own taste, like foodies or people who enjoy high-end dining and really get into the latest culinary trends. I mean, that is, I think, how a lot of people think about it, that there's sort of an ownership that certain groups of people have over what is good food. I mean, what's the problem with that?
Exactly. It's the fancy people. It's the fancy foodie people, isn't it, Gina?
It sure is.
And then there's the rest of us. Yeah. So taste is something we all have and we all do. It doesn't just belong to that small, sophisticated group of people. We all shape this construct. And, you know, I really believe that we should define deliciousness for ourselves. That, you know, if we were just going to leave it up to the foodies, then we should all just look at, like, the restaurants that have the most Michelin stars or the best Yelp reviews and just go with those. But I refuse to do that. I want to define these parameters for myself, and I want you to do the same. And that's why I've included in every chapter tasting guides. Because honestly, if I just say to you, hey, Gina, try diverse varieties of chocolate, okay, you know, I mean, I don't even know where I'd start with that.
It's a tough assignment, Simran.
It's a tough, I mean, it's a good one, you know, but it's a tough one because where do we even begin? Or I think about, you know, if you think of a sommelier who kind of sniffs the wine and says, you know, golden berries, honeydew, wheat.
A hint of tobacco.
A hint of, yes, exactly. And I'm just sort of staring at them and thinking, like, I taste wine, I taste wine, I taste wine. We all have a starting point. We all need to know how to ground ourselves in this experience. And through my research, I've really looked at how do these tastemakers get defined? And, you know, one of the main things that separates the rookies from the pros is they have a language for it. So I've given in each chapter tasting guides. You can get together with your friends, drink some wine together. I show you how to compare two chocolates side by side. And I've also given you flavor wheels. So guidance on the language that people use. So you have a starting point. So you can say, oh, that does kind of taste like fruit. Is it cherries? Is it citrus? Like, you can find your place in this, and then you can move from there and define your own deliciousness for yourself.
Speaking of my place in this and finding my deliciousness for myself, I would like to talk about chocolate. But first, tell me about your relationship with chocolate.
You know, like I said at the start of the show, chocolate has been my constant companion. I mean, it has mended many a broken heart that I have had. It has been at many celebrations. And I describe in the book, I was like, chocolate is mine and mine alone, right? We share the bottle of wine. We may have coffee with a friend. But chocolate to me is something intimate. It's something I do by myself. We're not yet at a point of sharing bars of chocolate together as a social event. And I don't mind because I like to hoard my chocolate. But what I also realized is, like, you know, and I started off, like, you know, with whatchamacallits and Twix. Like, I have a huge range of what I love. But what I learned was that through the evolution of chocolate, we're losing some of the most delicious varieties. And some people balk when they see, like, a $13 bar of chocolate and just think, that's insane. I was certainly one of those people who thought, well, that's a pretty hefty price to pay for something I'm going to eat in 2 minutes. But what I learned is what chocolate experts had already told me that I didn't believe, which is you will savor this slowly. It is so delicious. It's the equivalent of, like, flipping through, I don't know, a People magazine versus reading a really good book. Like, one you're going to take your time with and really savor, and the other one you're going to move through quickly.
But Simran, I want to jump in because what is it that makes chocolate or the plant it comes from, cacao, a food we're in danger of losing?
What we're in danger of losing is the best of varieties of it because of diseases. Diseases that have sinister-sounding names like witch's broom and frosty pod rot. And they are effectively wiping out some of the most diverse varieties of cacao. Simultaneously, we are increasing the development or the growth of varieties that have very high yield but don't have great flavor profiles, to use a kind of expert term. The hybrid that has become most prolific is one called CCN51, and it is a cacao is what becomes chocolate. These little seeds, we eat the seeds of the fruit of the cacao, and they look like giant colored footballs, and they're ridged and they're kind of stuck on trees. It's like fantastical. It's like you're in a Dr. Seuss story, you know, when you go to a cacao forest.
That's what it sounds like.
It really, it's absolutely astonishing. I mean, you know, a coffee plant kind of looks like coffee, you know, but cacao is like nothing else. It's extraordinary. And the variety that we're growing, the CCN51 in large measure, is wiping out and replacing all those diverse varieties, but it grows very quickly and it has a lot of disease resistance. The problem is the taste is described by experts as something akin to rusty nails. Now, I don't know about you, but there was an actual piece on NPR where they said, I guess if we want chocolate in the future, this is what we're going to have to settle for. But that is not the case. We can save and protect these chocolates. There are incredible chocolate makers all over the country. Rogue Chocolatier, Patrick, Askenozy, you're going to be speaking with Sean later, who are definitely committed to saving the most precious varieties. And they're doing it because the taste is something extraordinary. They're doing it because they know by preserving these diverse varieties, we're going to have those options in the future. If we just grow one thing, we're going to have it now. We're probably going to have the mediocre wine forever, the mediocre chocolate forever. I don't want to settle. I want to have food that's really good and really delicious. I don't want the things I love to disappear.
Let's go ahead and hear from Sean Askenozy. He's the founder and CEO of Askenozy Chocolate in Springfield, Missouri. You may have seen his chocolates in coffee shops around town here in Kansas City. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I mean, can you talk a little bit about, from your perspective, you have direct trade with chocolate producers, with growers of cacao in four different continents. What is your perspective on, like, the future of chocolate?
Well, thank you for asking, and thank you for Simran for shining the light on this very important issue. This is so important. And if I could just rewind the tape 1 minute, I think there's something very important to address about something that Simran said with respect to saving food by savoring taste. And it's so important that we think about diversity of flavor so that we don't have this monoculture of cocoa. But here's the thing. I'm a very small company. There's just 15 of us total, and we're direct trading on four continents. I'm buying cocoa beans from farmers that we have the name of. We have the name of every single farmer. We profit share with those farmers. But here's the deal. If you combine me and all of my brother and sister chocolate makers, small batch chocolate makers in the world, we comprise an infinitesimal percentage of cocoa that's produced in the world. What I'm saying is that we can have all kinds of policies and practices, including me, but if we don't do something before we're concerning ourselves with flavor to save the people before the food, then flavor isn't going to matter. Let me give you the example. There's 6 million cocoa farmers in the world. Half of them reside in Ghana and Ivory Coast, where I don't buy beans from. Those farmers, 3 million cocoa farmers, make between 50 and 84 cents a day. And so when Simran was talking about the Twix bar that she liked, and me too, and the little Snickers bar or whatever, fill in the blank bar, 100% certain the farmers who contributed the few cocoa beans that went into that bar are making between 50 and 84 cents a day, which is significantly below the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals of $1.25 a day. So we've got to do something to save people. Exactly. To save these poor farmers before we can really, really dig into how we're going to save flavor.
Yeah, and I want the two of you to interact about this a little bit, because Simran writes about, you know, that chocolate is largely a cash crop for the people who make it because they don't get to eat it. So they can't be making it for the love of chocolate. They can't afford to eat the product that they produce. And Sean, and yeah, Simran, I want you to talk about that a little bit first, how that affects the fate of chocolate more broadly.
Well, quality gets compromised when, and you know, Carla Martin from Harvard University says in the book, you know, she talked about like farmers can't treat a crop well when it treats them so poorly. And I identify what Sean is talking about specifically in my coffee chapter. But one of the big things that we're seeing in chocolate, in coffee, in agriculture is when things are cheap, you have to ask yourself, who isn't getting paid? And it is not the chocolate companies. It is not the CEOs, the people who are constantly at the very bottom of this chain of creation. The farmers in the countries where the cacao grows, where the coffee grows, not where it turns into a commodity and becomes a fancy bar, or where it becomes, you know, a fancier cup of coffee per se, the global north. It is the poorest of the poor who are absorbing the most risk. If you imagine you put all of your time, energy, money into a crop. You have to wait to see what you're going to make for it once it grows and once it's harvested. And in particular with cacao, we aren't at a place yet where we can ferment small amounts of it. So we're really talking about farmers having to contribute to a larger pool of cacao that will get fermented. And this, you know, this is one of the most punishing equations that we see in food. And I'm really glad that Sean brought this up, because what I want people to know is you make whatever decisions you want to make. 70% of our chocolate comes from West Africa, from Ivory Coast and Ghana. If that's the chocolate that you choose, then you should know that that chocolate was probably harvested by children, and people are making a very small amount of money. If you choose Sean's chocolate, where he is engaged in direct trade, where he knows those farmers' names, where he cares about those farmers and he is not in isolation with that, you're making a different set of decisions that puts a different kind of trajectory into being. And I would say right now it's small with chocolate, but what we see happening with craft beer is another perfect example. Craft beer now outsells, you know, Bud Light and kind of commercialized beer. And we see coffee, the specialty coffee industry, you know, growing exponentially while commodity coffee has remained stagnant.
So that's a source of hope.
Do you think there's hope there
for chocolate? Sean, you want to jump in?
Well, if I could, the thing is, and everything that Simran said, I agree with completely. The thing is, though, we are not going to change the equation by insisting on all farmers around the world improving the quality of their product. That is not going to work. We have to reorient the question to say to ourselves, one, why is it so cheap, which is what Simran brought up. But secondly, if we adjust the commodity price for cocoa for inflation, it has not changed in 30 years. Neither has the yield. And so what we have to ask is, there are eight companies controlling the price, the commodity price of cocoa. And we have to say to ourselves as a society, as a consuming culture, what are we going to do about this fact? It's remained the same for 30 years. We can say, well, we're going to reward farmers if they have better quality and higher quality. And I do. I pay farmers if they do the things that I ask them to do, as we should. But what I'm trying to say is, it's not going to move the needle.
Sean, I want you to tell us a little bit more about those personal experiences you've had. There's one that you reference on your website that especially intrigues me in the context of this conversation about the lives of farmers, that you gave a cacao farmer his first chocolate bar.
Well, every trip that we take, we bring chocolate back to farmers made with their beans. And we have these chocolate tastings. And it's quite an experience, because universally, the farmers who are tasting chocolate that we make from their beans hold this little piece of chocolate, which is, by the way, in a very hot and humid tropical climate, between, you know, a thumb and index finger, and they look at it and they hold it with reverence. And this has been universal for me. Every trip that I take, and I go to all these places every year, and I've been doing it for 10 years, amazing to watch them interact with each other about the chocolate, and a big deal. And I would say the thing that makes it a big deal is the relationship that we have with the farmers. There's one farmer in particular in Africa who is one of the elders of the village. Last summer, when I was there in August, at the end of a little party that we had for the farmers, he came up to me with a bracelet, and it was a tribal bracelet handed to him by his father and from him by his grandfather. And he gave that bracelet to me. And I, you know, said to myself then, you know, that this is really what defines success for me. One of the things that we say in our factory is, it's not about the chocolate, it's about the chocolate. And that story that I related is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It's not about the chocolate.
Simran,
but it is about the chocolate.
Yeah, Simran, you had an experience with an Ecuadorian chocolate producer, and who you asked, you know, what do you want people to know about the chocolate that they're eating? And he told you that the producer who's growing cacao is making a big sacrifice. Do you think that this is that's the same conversation?
I do. I think, but he also added that we're growing this because for the love, like we love this. And he was talking specifically about Nacional, which is a cluster of varieties of cacao grown in Ecuador and in Peru, and is being slowly wiped out by this high yielding variety CCN. So farmers replace the stuff that's grown with this higher yielding mediocre stuff. And what I really loved was hearing how it was part of his identity of who he was. But we can't expect farmers to grow this for valor. There is a very, as Sean has cited beautifully, you know, there's a strong system in place to ensure that people will stay hungry and people will stay impoverished and will grow what is demanded of them. But I'll tell you, like, I want people to feel empowered to change this. In 10 years of working in environmental issues, I have shared with people everything from, you know, get on your bike and get out of your car and put on a sweater and turn down the heat. And this is joyful. This is an opportunity that we have to be part of the solution if we are informed enough to do so. And it is listening to people like Sean. It is reading the stories of chocolate makers and farmers. And it is understanding their stories. I think that can be transformative. It's really hard when you think those farmers out there. I remember even for myself, I had a fuzzy idea of farmers in fields and, you know, workers in factories. I mean, aside from the ones I would meet every week at my farmer's market. And And it's hard. It's hard to keep your eye on people who aren't there. But what we can do is bring that experience close. And what Sean was describing as a sacred moment of eating that chocolate, that sanctity can also be a part of our everyday life, that reverence and that gratitude for what we have.
Simran Sadie, author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Simran's talk is tomorrow evening at KU's Spooner Hall. And Sean Eskenazy of Eskenazy Chocolate in Springfield, Missouri, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. We've got another story about the effects of the environment. Here in Kansas City, we'd like to think we're all about population growth here, except for certain populations of animals, that is. It's Nature in the City, and KCUR's Brianna O'Higgins has the story of why a certain species of bird is really getting on the city's nerves.
Kansas City is Beverly Hills for geese. They have everything they need, says Missouri state biologist Todd Mays. Open lakes and fountains, grass that is almost always green and rarely covered in thick snow. Few, if any, predators.
They have everything here. There's no need to leave. And they're long-lived. I mean, 10 to 24 years, there's basically no predators other than us.
Canada geese are considered migratory, even though many have lost the instinct. Mays says it's due to development and changing agricultural practices. Each fall around this time, geese who still migrate come to Kansas City for the winter. Then they get comfy and breed.
Those migrating geese will inbreed with the non-migrators, and then whenever they have young, the young imprint here, so they come back to breed. So a nesting pair of geese, two geese, can end up 50 geese in 5 years.
That is a lot of geese, and a lot of geese make a lot of poop.
A goose is said to defecate every 7 minutes. So wherever they're at in a large group, every 7 minutes, there's a new pile on the ground, and then accumulates, and people are walking in it.
And goose poop is pretty nasty. It carries coliform, E. coli.
Some really nasty stuff that, you know, little kids at parks don't need to be picking up and investigating.
That's Dave Swickard. He owns Geese Police of Kansas City. He and his border collie, Gail, can rid your property of geese and their poop in a matter of weeks. But he doesn't hunt them. You can hunt geese during goose season in Missouri, but many cities and towns don't allow it. Last year, the city hired him to redirect geese from public spaces like Luce Park and J.C. Nichols Fountain.
What's different about a border collie than any other dog is the fact that their stalking mechanism is not a chase behavior. So their head's down, their tail shot between their legs, and they're not barking and chasing. We have more of a controlled stalk. Now, they do sometimes, if the geese are in certain areas, they'll go ahead and run after them, but not before they've stalked them.
Just a mile away from Luce Park, with the city bustling around them, geese stroll and poop around a small lake near the Kauffman Foundation.
Gail, that'll do. Gail, that'll do.
Gail slowly moves in low to the ground, then suddenly and quickly startles the flock, sending them to another area. It takes a lot more than one stalking to redirect geese out of an area. Gail and Dave will do this over and over until the geese no longer feel safe and find somewhere else to go. In places with larger lakes, Dave will even work in tandem with Gail on a kayak, clearing geese from the middle of the water while she clears them from the perimeter. But while redirecting the geese keeps parks and public areas clean for residents, it doesn't do much to control the population. Remember the two geese scenario? 50 in 5 years.
Addling eggs can be a couple different processes.
Both Dave from Geese Police and biologist Todd Mays from the Missouri Department of Conservation use the addling technique of population control. Todd says the most common is coating the egg in oil so it can't breathe. The other is shaking the egg to scramble the insides.
But there is a controlled process to do this because the male and female both watch the nest, mainly the female. So you have to, the day you oil them or addle them, you got to record that day. And you have to remove the eggs within, it's 21 or 24 days, something like that. Because if you don't, the female will sit on them. If you remove them too early, she'll just reproduce again, lay more eggs.
Last year was the first time Kansas City, Missouri put resources behind controlling the Canada goose population in the city. They started with the Brush Creek Corridor east of Brookside and oiled 402 eggs in 75 nests. They also spent thousands of dollars on redirecting geese from parks and fountains, so residents would have clear pathways, beautiful grass, and they would be a little safer.
So I don't know why, but they like to land on your head, peck your nose, and that's their defense mechanism, I guess.
At least the geese have some method for fighting for their Beverly Hills.
KCUR's Brianna O'Higgins brought us that installment of Nature in the City. That's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed hearing about the new book, Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love, Simran Sadie will be giving a talk at KU's Spooner Hall tomorrow evening. We'll link to more information when we post the audio from that discussion later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the plaza's for sale for just a little upwards of $300 million. But what's the value of the plaza in non-monetary terms? Plus, a round table of Santas, but which one's real? Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to the fine folks at KPR. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.